Tonight on Arena, the epic journey of Little Amal, a refugee girl in the form of a 10-foot-tall puppet, and Ransom 79, one final piece of journalism from Charlie Bird. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on the live stream, which is on rte.ie/arena. Ransom 79 is a documentary that tells the story of the legendary news reporter Charlie Bird and his determination to investigate one last story before his life was sadly cut short by motor neuron disease. 40 years after the most bizarre letter arrived in the Department of Agriculture, the information fell into the lap of Charlie Bird, who decided to find out more alongside fellow journalist and playwright Colin Murphy. Colin is with me in studio this evening, as is the director of Ransom 79, Colm Quinn. You know, Colin, if you saw this as a fiction, you'd say, ah, come on.
Yeah, but aren't they always the best stories?
You know, yeah.
You couldn't make it up.
No. You had... Well, actually, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to play a clip of This is Charlie, and for the purposes of the film, this is the first time you ever hear about this story that Charlie has. He phoned you up because you'd worked with him on a play previously. Let's listen to Charlie say it in his words to you.
Colin, it was great working with you on the play. I've got a lead on a story that I'd like to cover with you. This one is stranger. It's about a ransom demand on the government that's been kept secret for more than 40 years. A former head of the fraud squad for Goals, Willie McGee, told me the story. He kept it to himself all these years and never shared it. Till now. I'm sending you the documents I have along with my notes. It's from 1979, a formative year for me as a young journalist. The RTE newsroom was a pretty intense place to be. On the same day that August, the IRA killed Lord Mountbatten and two children when they blew up his boat, and killed 18 British soldiers in the Warren Point ambush. Little did any of us know, there was also an attack on the state underway, one with potentially devastating consequences. And this attack was happening right under our noses.
Visuals. There you go. That's the voice of Charlie Bird in a scene from the documentary, the opening scene practically of Ransom 79. And Colin Murphy, the man who is addressed in that opening statement, is with me in studio, as is Colm Quinn, director of the film. You had worked, I was saying beforehand, Colin, you had worked with Charlie on a play, A Day in May, which was all about the famous referendum, the equal marriage referendum back in the day. Here he approaches you with this. What was in that set of documents that he sent you? You could, as I said, you couldn't make it up.
Well, I mean, he had the Garda file. So, you know, the documents, they had this lovely texture as well. They were 40 years old and more. And they were ransom letters, you know, like, now they weren't quite, you know, cut out letters pasted together like we used to do when we were making a ransom. But essentially it was, you know, a letter typed up on a battered old typewriter, a typewriter that the guards, of course, you know, tried to trace as part of the investigation. And it said, "Dear Minister, this is a demand for £5 million."
And it's the very opening sentence to get straight to the point. This is a demand for £5 million. I mean, talk about laying out your stall immediately.
Absolutely. And then they said, you know, "We have secured foot and mouth virus and we're going to release it into the national herd." This is 1979. There's not much else in the Irish economy other than the Irish herd.
Yeah.
Unless you pay us £5 million. But stand by for further instructions and to let us know that you've got this message and that you're taking us seriously. We're not going to give you an address you can write to us at. We're not going to give you a phone number, obviously. Mm. You're to take out a small ad in the back of the Irish Times saying, "Tom Smith has received your message and awaits further information."
I know those. And when you see, as we do in the film, Colm, those shots of the Irish Times from 1979 and later on, because there are several communications of this kind into the beginning of 1980, it really evokes a different world where, you know, communication was made in a very different way.
It really does, yeah. I mean, there's such a lovely sort of texture to those letters and to the ads from a graphic design point of view. And that was something we were able to have a bit of fun with, I think, in terms of the overall design approach. But yeah, I mean, I think it's something that comes across in the reenactments as well. You know, like we really try to kind of capture the atmosphere.
You have reenactments of the era, which bring us right back to that point, including the moment when the letter arrived into the Department of Agriculture, and it was one of the officials there, female official, brings it up to the Secretary General saying, "I think you better take a look at this." Quite an extraordinary nose and eye that she had to spot that. What do you think it was about the letter, Colin, that made it stand out?
Apart from the fact that there was a demand for £5 million,
yeah, but she, you know, they would have been getting, as it says in the film, they got all sorts of kooky letters along the way, but this one was different.
Yeah, it was interesting. So one of the things we did in the investigation was we got a forensic psychiatrist, Gautam Gulati, who had been specifically trained in hostage negotiation, amongst other things, in the States, to look at and assess it. And one of the things he does is he assesses the intent, the level, he tries to deduce the seriousness of intent behind it, using various kind of metrics. So that's what they would have been doing. And obviously in the department, these officials were doing that kind of instinctively. But the letter is well crafted. It's elaborate. There's a lot of detail in it. It does demand that it be taken seriously.
Yeah, and even though there are a few typos, again, that brings you back to 1979, when there would have been Tipex. Just about been Tipex at that time. But that's why typing was such an essential skill, to have your letter typewritten neatly without errors. But the fraud squad and the Gardaí become involved in the case via the Department of Agriculture, and they come up with three possibilities which you lay out for us and say, well, that should be what we should be trying to prove in this film.
Yeah, and helpfully in a freedom of information request into the department, we got a memo from the time that set out the possibilities. And I think the possibilities were, one, the most serious. This was absolutely true. There was a gang out there. They did a foot and mouth. They were prepared to release it if not paid the money. The second possibility was there was a gang out there. They didn't have foot and mouth. They were chancing their arms, but they were deadly serious about trying to get the money. And the third one was that it was just entirely a hoax. It was possibly some kid in his bedroom.
And that then becomes yourself and Charlie go about investigative journalism to find out which of those three possibilities in fact were the case. And we won't spoil it by saying what the end of the series thing was. At what point, Colin, was it Colin, was it Charlie who came to you and said, there's a film in this, there's a documentary in this?
Yeah, it was actually the producer, John Kelleher, gave me a shout, and he was telling me about a podcast that Charlie had done for Senior Times called Ransom 79, and had laid out the initial sort of foundational aspects of this story, I guess. But it was absolutely riveting, and John was thinking, yeah, there's something we can do here. So we met up with Charlie, and Charlie was super enthusiastic about it from the get-go. We sort of developed it over a couple of months, just to get a sense of how exactly we could turn it into a documentary, like where an investigation might actually have to go.
Yeah.
But yeah,
because in lots of ways, the action of this is Charlie and Colin sitting reading through documents. That's the essential action, which isn't exactly cinematic, is it? So you had to find a way of making it cinematic.
Well, this is exactly it, Sean. You know, and I mean, I think that was one of the things we wanted to get across in the film. It's just the sheer amount of graft and hard work that goes into good journalism. You know, but yeah, I mean, I think there's some absolutely fascinating scenes between Charlie and Colin, not just when they're following the investigation and sort of trying to unravel the mystery.
Yeah.
But also I think in those scenes, you get a very sort of clear sense of the challenges that Charlie was facing with the motor neuron disease.
I mean, there are a couple of moments in it that kind of stop you in your tracks. At one point, Colin, it's yourself and Charlie in the room, and his words to the effect of, "I won't survive another year." and he's saying this directly to you. I mean, those must be incredibly difficult words to hear. And he says to you, you have to take this into account in your planning.
Mm.
I mean, the journalist's eye, the journalist's nose, despite the fact that he knew his life was coming to an end, he wanted to be sure that this story got told and that you were already thinking about the possibility that he wouldn't be there.
Yeah, absolutely. But that clarity in his mind and his confidence in me and his confidence in sharing his state of mind made what could have been a very difficult role to play for me much easier, because he was willing to be upfront about where he was at with his health and his state of mind.
The people you got to contribute to this are quite extraordinary as well. I mean, we have Gerry Collins is there as the then Minister for Justice. Ray McSherry is there as the then Minister for Agriculture, who would have been directly involved with this. Yeah. But astonishingly, you get to the... Who was it? He was the General Secretary. Am I giving him his correct title? Or former Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, Kevin Cassidy.
Private Secretary to the Minister, I think.
Private Secretary, give his correct title. Who had said absolutely nothing about this to anybody at any point in time. He had just sat on it the way things have to be sat on sometimes in that regard. Let's have a listen to a clip that gives us, you're talking to, first of all, we'll hear Charlie, then we'll hear Kevin Cassidy, that's the Secretary, and then Willie McGee, who's the former head of the Garda Fraud Squad.
Do you remember the guards calling to the department to collect the letter?
Yeah. Everybody who had any contact with the letter, we were all fingerprinted. That was the first indication we had that this was being taken very seriously. We were absolutely told that this was a totally need-to-know basis. We shouldn't discuss it with anybody, and we were not to discuss it in the private office. Other than you approaching me, I would never have revealed this story.
It was a short walk from Dublin Castle, where I was based at the time, down to Fleet Street to attend in the Irish Times office. And I filled out whatever forms were required and put in the wording of the ad, which was actually most unusual. Tom Smith has read your message and will consider your proposals. And that meant that we'll play along with the demands.
This story asks new questions about an era that shaped who I would become. And it will be my last.
There you go, Charlie Bird's voice. And we should say, I keep saying Charlie Bird's voice, but it was that the extraordinary technological facility that was there that Charlie could use a mixture of this, obviously from the amount of recordings of his own voice in the archive, he could communicate so effectively. And it sounds like him. You even addressed him about that particular point at one stage in the documentary as well, Colin.
Yeah, I was intrigued because, you know, he was carrying around this iPad and this little Bluetooth speaker connected to the iPad. And it was, even though it was kind of miraculous technology, it was also quite cumbersome because he had to type, quite slowly. And so you couldn't have a very fluent conversation. But the voice that came out of the speaker was absolutely...
And the fluency of the voice is what's extraordinary. Fabulous, to my mind.
But I wanted to know, what emotional relationship did he have with this? Did he find it kind of disassociating or alienating? And he said no, he'd absolutely, it was his voice coming out, he could hear that in it. It felt like a part of him, I think, at that stage.
Yeah, and again, in the recreations column that you have within all of this, they set up the facilities without going into all of the ins and outs of it, but they get into this, we find out that they're making these arrangements for the ransom to be, well, is it going to be paid over? Is it not going to be paid over? We don't really know. But you had to recreate 1970s Ireland, 1979's Ireland, 1979 signposts, 1979 cars. That must have been a lot of fun as well as a big challenge.
Yeah, it was, I think you'd call it fun, all right. Yeah, it was, we also built a section of O'Connell Street outside the Gresham Hotel for some minis to line up.
Yeah, because the idea was that the mini would be left out. So they wanted to see, you know, are you serious about handing over this money? And they were, if you put the mini there and we'll take a look at it and see if that works for us.
Exactly. They'd instructed it. It was a mini 1000, a white mini.
A white mini 1000
with English reg plates.
Yeah.
That was, you know,
a leather suitcase on the passenger seat. Yeah.
And what's lovely about that is it Willie McGee, I think it was. Yeah, the guard involved. he was minding his sister's car, who was, had happened to be a white mini, and he used that. Lovely little details like that that are in
but
there.
But also they had this clever, but there's a lot of accidental comedy in the film. And one of the things was the guards, they wanted to, you know, so obviously the gang were going to check that instructions had been followed and the mini was outside the Gresham. So they wanted to force the gang to have to stop and check. So they got two other minis. So there were three minis lined up in order that whoever from the gang was on surveillance was going to have to make an effort to work out was the one there with the suitcase.
Yeah.
And just there's something lovely about that, procuring three minis.
And lovely details too, like that they made sure that the Gardaí on duty put tickets on them so that they would, you know, it wouldn't look suspicious. How are these three minis parked here in this spot directly outside the Gresham Hotel and they don't have a parking ticket? All of that was carried out. Those kind of tiny little details, you really got a sense. I mean, it has that thriller aspect within it, doesn't it?
Yes, it was always somewhere between a caper and a thriller.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for all the accidental comedy, it does, it swerves, you know, it gets a lot darker later on. But there was certainly a sense, I had a sense kind of researching, investigating it, that this gang, on top of anything else, they were also enjoying themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to name any names. And certainly there's one name that is kept. And I remember Charlie's very clear on this in the documentary as well. Even as you have worked out who was involved, you've worked out a version, certainly a very viable version of what happened. But the men who were involved in this were not to be fooled with. Some of them, you know, served long prison sentences.
Yeah, absolutely. But they were also known for drinking the proceeds of a bank raid on Baggot Street of a Friday evening. You know, so it was again, it was this window into a very strange time in the quite recent past of the 1970s when, you know, there were some things were a lot more anarchic.
I think we can mention that there was an organisation, Sierra Era, and that was that organisation and people associated with it were intimately associated with this ransom demand.
Yeah, so Sierra Era were, you know, a Republican militant group in their own right, not a splinter of the IRA at that time, and very serious. But the way it was described to me by one of the people who was involved in those days was that these lads, the subject of our film, if they got caught on a job, then it was all about Sierra Era and they were political prisoners.
Yeah.
If they got away with the job, it was May Fein.
Yeah, and the money, the proceedings went to May Fein as well. I was thinking about this too, to what extent that kind of thriller stroke caper side of it, I mean, it's a caper at one point, but this is biological warfare. Before we knew perhaps in some ways what biological terrorism, I suppose we could really call it, Colm.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get a sense of that from the sheer scale of the reaction that took place at the time, the scale of the detail that the guards mounted, the involvement of the Navy at one point.
Yeah,
it was quite something to see, just the scale of it. Really.
And again, I think the other important things that you'd have to say is here is the professionalism of the Gardaí and all of the possibilities that they had worked out, including this possibility that the money might be thrown over the bridge in New Ross and that there would be a boat there to whip it out to sea. Like, they had thought of everything.
Yeah, they really had. But I mean, they had two naval ships stationed in Waterford Estuary. The ships, and very luckily we managed to find the commander, and they didn't know exactly what was going on. They just knew they were stationed there and that something might happen. But the Navy doesn't have powers of arrest.
Yeah.
So they had special branch on board the ships in order to authorise arrests of anybody they might catch.
And of course, you know, then we do come to the end of the film and we know at this stage that obviously Charlie has left us at this point. It must have been, even watching that first screening, did you watch it with family and friends, Charlie's family and friends?
Yeah, I did, absolutely, yeah. And Claire, his wife was in the film as well and was a producer on the film as well, was there. Like, in some ways, I think maybe we did some of my grieving through the making of the film. And we watched it through extensive edits over a long time.
And did Charlie get to see much of that finished product?
Yeah, I mean, he did. Yeah, he saw a complete edit without some of the bells and whistles of sort of sound mix and grading and stuff very late. And then very late in the day, we'd made some tweaks that we wanted to run by him. And I brought the laptop down to him And at that stage, he was, it was just a few weeks before he died, he was completely prone. And I really didn't want for him to last much longer in that condition. But he completely lit up when he saw it.
He was delighted. It's wonderful to think that. And I think we leave the last words to him. This is towards the end of the film, and it's just a beautiful moment when he's speaking at the hospice in, I can't remember the location of the hospice he's speaking in at this moment in time.
In Wicklow.
Here he is, Charlie Bird, to finish it out.
I was very scared during the first year of my illness. I couldn't face the relentless decline that lay ahead. But then I had an epiphany. Derek Mahon has a poem called Against the Clock. He writes, we're obliged to stick it out until the pen falls from the trembling hand. I believe a spirit has been sitting on my shoulder through this, guiding me. I believe the spirit is there because of the kindness and prayers that have been offered for me by the people of this country. I love every one of you. I may be preparing to die, but I am still getting on with living. Thank you.
Shall the rose inviden hev, synish invain trwca ty tre, mychel y trawa na dawn gael tren, dy fawr na gnoch syni.
Strains of Seamhlaigh Mhuireadh Mar there, the music that finishes out that section from the documentary we've been speaking about. The documentary is called Ransom 79. Colin Murphy and director Colm Quinn discussing it with me in studio this evening. There will be a screening of the film at the Fastnet Film Festival in Skull tomorrow before it goes on wider release on Friday, May the 24th. And Colin will also be doing a Q&A at the AFI on that night. In her latest book, The Other Side, Australian writer, artist and critic Jennifer Higgy explores the extraordinary life of a group of 19th and early 20th century female artists whose often visionary work was informed by an interest in spiritualism, the afterlife and the occult. While painters like Hilma af Klint and Georgina Houghton created work that seemed to anticipate surrealism and abstract art by many decades, they died forgotten, ignored by the rationalism of the patriarchy. Jennifer Higgy will be discussing her book at events in Dundalk and Dublin this weekend, but I'm delighted she joins me on the line this evening. Like a lot of people, I think, who come to the other side, Jennifer, I did approach this with a certain amount of scepticism, I have to say. You know, when you hear about the occult, you hear about spiritualism, and particularly that period in time, the 19th and into the early 20th century, it maybe is no harm sometimes to have your critical antennae up. How did you manage that? Because you are not cynical about it, but you're not gauche and naive about it either.
No, you know, I think, you know, I think that we can get too wrapped up in words like occult. And the original meaning of that word was simply hidden knowledge. And if we look at the history of art, if we look at like the Renaissance, for example, where would the Renaissance be without its devils and its angels and its humans being affected by celestial agency? You know, pretty much all pre-modern art was shaped and really inspired by various aspects of the spirit world, be it religion, be it dreams, be it ritual, fairy tale, you know, it's always been there. I'm just sort of looking at it again and thinking, actually, there's something in this. It's interesting.
Yeah, and when you use the term hidden knowledge, then it becomes something else. You know, many's a night on this very programme, I've heard artists talking about trying to tap into the subconscious, trying to get to that hidden part of themselves. And when you think of it in those terms, perhaps it doesn't merit the same amount of scepticism.
Exactly. I mean, just think, we all spend a third of our lives asleep and dreaming. I mean, that has an effect on us, you know, and I use the word spirit world very broadly in my book as well. You know, I'm looking at, like, you know, how does the unconscious impact on the making of art as well as these, you know, more formal religions and things?
What about that period in time, you know, particularly the mid-19th century? And let's face it, there were a lot of chancers going around with ideas around spiritualism at that time as well. But what do you think it was about that mid-19th and early 20th century period that particularly led to a rise in spiritualism?
You know, well, what is really interesting, and it was sort of surprising to me when I found out about it, was the alignment of spiritualism with scientific discovery. I mean, this was a time of extraordinary discovery. You know, we've got X-rays for the first time. You can look inside a body. You've never been able to do that before. With a telegram, you can send words across oceans. You know, with electricity, we can have light without fire. You know, so it was a time of great exploration. And many of the physicists, actually, like Marie Curie and Thomas Edison, they were really interested in spiritualism. And in fact, Thomas Edison quite seriously tried to invent a spirit telephone where you could call the dead. And a lot of the physicists were saying that what we understand about time isn't necessarily accurate. Maybe it's stacked up instead of being linear. And so a lot of the spiritualists who were women, they were interested in science. And of course, they had no political agency at this point. And so many of them were also interested in female suffrage, in females, you know, getting the vote. So a lot of these things sort of correspond with each other. And in America, spiritualism was very closely aligned with abolitionism as well. So, you know, it's actually on the right side of history in many ways, apart from the chances.
And I suppose the other point about that is, and I wondered, it's not quite the thesis of the book that these female artists were dismissed because of that spiritual side, or if we, to use that awful rational and emotional, to use that terrible divide, but however, just for the purposes of our discussion, you know, that it's easy, those who are painting with that kind of background, it's easy to dismiss them as being precisely that, irrational and over emotional. But as you say, I mean, well, the same thing was done to female scientists, let's face it, as well. They were kind of expunged from the history books. Do you think the artists were treated in a different way in that respect?
You know, it depends which artists we're talking about in a way, because there were so many different artists in so many different groups. A lot of women who were interested in spiritualism were also interested in art, and they were very supportive of each other. Women who sort of tried to go a little bit more mainstream, you know, they had a mixed reception. Georgiana Houghton, she made these paintings which are like a cosmic Jackson Pollock in the 1860s, and she hired a gallery in New Bond Street here in London, and she exhibited her paintings, and actually she got some quite good reviews. But she said most of the real interest came from other artists who were looking at her work. But the thing was, if we move into the 20th century, we've got a lot of big male artists, the ones that everyone's heard of, like Mondrian, Kandinsky, Paul Klee. All of them were interested in spiritualism. They were paid up theosophists. They were very interested in the spirit world, yet they were taken seriously. So there is a bit of a gender divide in terms of what was considered serious.
Yeah, and a man interested in spiritualism and Kandinsky, everybody will talk about the mathematical and the shapes and the geometric in his work and perhaps not emphasize that spiritual side, which of course was there as well. I guess the name that comes up most often is Madame Blavatsky, of course, associated with our own William Butler Yeats.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he tried to, under her sort of influence, he tried to, what was it, raise the ghost of flowers, I think. You know, you know, he loved theosophy and he was absolutely fascinated by her. And by all accounts, she was a fascinating woman. I mean, she did use, I think it's fairly clear, a gentle word would be untruths, to explore what she saw as truth. So there was a paradox to the way she thought. But, you know, she was a huge character. She was the first Russian woman to get an American passport. She said she'd lived for 9 years in Tibet, learning from masters there. You know, she communicated with spirits. But that said, she was one of the first big thinkers to bring or to highlight the importance of Eastern mysticism and Eastern religions in the West. So in a way, she's the beginning of the New Age movement.
And again, a thing that comes up with Blavatsky in particular, and I think an artist we might speak a little bit more about, Hilma af Klint. But sticking with the Yeats Association and Georgie Hyde, his wife, of course, who talked about this automatic writing.
Yes.
There was a touch of this within the artists, and I think Hilma af Klint was particularly this idea of automatic, am I using the right term when I say automatic painting?
You're absolutely using the right term. And that was the term that the Surrealists, with André Breton in Paris in his 1924 first Surrealist Manifesto, he really championed this idea of automatic writing. And everyone, you know, sort of assumed that he had thought this up. But actually, this was something that was happening in the 19th century, and it was about channeling spirits. And Hilmer F. Klint did it. You know, she had many spirit guides who she quite clearly said helped direct her hand. And many of the spiritualist artists had these spirits who were guiding them in writing and in making pictures. So, you know, who am I to disbelieve that? They made wonderful pictures. They often wrote wonderful things. So, you know, I'm happy to look at their achievements rather than be too skeptical.
How would you describe the word of Hilma af Klint in that respect?
How would I describe her work?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons she's become so hugely popular, I mean, her show at the Guggenheim in New York still is the best-selling exhibition that they've ever staged. And, you know, when it opened, people were going, who's she? And then something like 800,000 people came to see it. And I think this is why one of the reasons her work is so marvelous, because yes, you can be interested in her, you know, ideas of spirit guidance and talking to other realms and talking to the dead. But when you look at these works, they're just extremely beautiful, abstract, joyful, you know, they're huge. You walk into the gallery and it's like you're surrounded by, you know, ecstatic bubbles of color. And so whatever your, you know, position on all of the spirit world is or not, you can appreciate the colour and the sheer inventiveness and there's something joyful about her work.
Yeah, so comparisons I think are made within one in the book at one of the critics that you quote, I think, compares her to Mark Rothko or indeed Alice Martin, both of whom were painted a half a century later.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, the theory that I was taught when I was at art school in the 80s and 90s was that Kandinsky invented abstraction in the West in 1911. But, you know, Hilmer F. Klint was doing these enormous things in 1906. And we see other extraordinary artists experimenting what we might call abstraction now in the 19th century, in the 1860s. So, yeah, it's
idea of the received writing or the automatic writing, that somehow the artist is just simply a vessel for this material that comes through them. Paul Muldoon was on with us recently, and we used this phrase about getting yourself out of the way, which in some ways is the same type of thing. But he was very keen to point out, yes, of course you get yourself out of the way to get the material going, but then there has to be some kind of, you know, the artist isn't just a passive receiver of material. Yeah. The artist then has to shape it. Would you say that these women artists that you are featuring in the book, they would have believed the same thing? Would they have shaped subsequent to the receiving, if you like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have, say, with Georgiana Houghton in the 1860s, she wonderfully left behind an autobiography. And so we have a very clear idea of what her relationship was with her spirits. And she, you know, had quite an argumentative relationship with them. And the relationship that Hilmer F. Klint had with her spirit guides was also quite active. But, you know, I think if you just take away the word spirit guide and replace it with inspiration, that's what every artist deals with. Every artist deals with inspiration. And, you know, they get ideas, often they don't understand them, but they have to interpret them. They have to make them into a piece of writing or into a picture. And so, you know, that's in a way how I see it, that this word spirit guide is really just the creative act, really,
inspiration,
which is
again
a mysterious one.
Yeah,
it's a mysterious alchemical one.
Yeah, yeah. And when you use inspiration or hidden knowledge, it has a different feel to it. Briefly, exactly. Anna, you might give us a sense of why you think Janet Sobel is so significant.
Well, she was making work really, which looks like there's a great painting in the Museum of Modern Art by her. She was a housewife. She was helping her husband run his business. Her son went to art school. This is in New York. She was a refugee from what we now call Ukraine. And she came from a Jewish family. So she was just a mother running the household. Her son went to art school. She started playing around with his materials. And before Jackson Pollock had even sort of started making Jackson Pollocks, here she was making swirling, abstract, wild paintings. And Peggy Guggenheim actually saw these pictures because her son was championing her and put her in an exhibition. Jackson Pollock saw these paintings that she was doing. And then he goes on to make his famous strip paintings. And I'm not saying he copied them. I'm just saying that he saw that this was an interesting new way of possibly making pictures, and he was inspired by her.
Yeah, or he may, he may have developed on from her, but it was developing on from something pre-existing.
Exactly.
One final question, if I could. Surely everything has changed now, and if a female artist were to express an interest in the occult, everybody would say, "Ah, yeah, that's fine. Let her at it."
Absolutely, you know, and lots of artists are exploring, you know, other realms now and different ways of understanding the world and esoteric knowledges. And, you know, I think it's extremely popular now. And there have been big museum shows around this very subject now. So, you know, so the underground has gone mainstream. Let's put it like that.
Right. I'll take that one. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean. I've really enjoyed it.
That's Jennifer Higgy. And Jennifer's book, The Other Side, A Journey to Women, Art and the Spirit World, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Jennifer will be in conversation this Friday, May the 24th, at Roe River Books in Dundalk. That's at 7 p.m. And on Sunday, May the 26th, she'll be at Books Upstairs in Dublin. And that is at 2:30 p.m. Little Amal, a 10-year-old Syrian girl, left the Syrian-Turkish border in July 2021. She journeyed throughout Europe, met a million people on her quest to find safety and a better life. She was accompanied, like so many other refugee children who have lost their parents. She was unaccompanied, I beg your pardon, like so many other refugee children who have lost their parents. She, though, is a 12-foot-tall puppet. Since 2021, Amal has travelled to 16 countries and has been welcomed by 2 million people on the street and by tens of millions online. Little Amal will arrive in Dublin later this week, having already visited Belfast and Derry. I'm delighted to be joined this evening by Amir Nizar Zurbi, Creative Director of Walk with Amal. Amir, lovely to have you with us on the programme. Thousands of miles little Amal has walked already, and I love the irony that the almost 10-foot-tall puppet is called Little Amal. She's been in Europe, she's been in America. What inspired you to embark on this ambitious project back 6 years ago now, 2018?
Thanks for having me. Well, the urgency and the need, and unfortunately it's still urgent and there's still a need. The ever growing, changing crisis of the refugees in Europe, it started with the Syrian revolution. It suddenly became very visible. But it's an ongoing crisis, and obviously as we're walking in Ireland, right now it's a topic that is very much in the news.
Yes. And
the idea was to create a theatrical project that changes the paradigm, that tries to shift the narrative and to think of refugees not as something that we need to feel sorry for or as something that we need to fear, but as part of the history of mankind. The story of mankind is the story of movement, is the story of people going to new places, bringing with them new cultures, new influences, learning, teaching. This exchange of knowledge is who we are. It's the best attribute of us as a species. And of course, walking in Ireland is very interesting also because of the internal very complicated history, but also because of the very long history of migration in and out of this island.
Yes, and the fact that you've started in the north of the island and are making your way down into the southern part of the island in itself is in some ways an artistic and political statement, I would venture to say. It was a play called The Jungle, I think, was part of the inspiration for Little Amal. Tell us a little bit about that play, Amir.
The Jungle was created in the Young Vic Theatre, run by David Land, by Good Chance Company, by two very talented playwrights, Joe Roberts and Joe Murphy. And it explored the realities, the very brutal realities of the Calais jungle, the refugee camp in Calais, which then was named The Jungle. as a result of the engagement of the team, especially David, as the producer, with the refugee issue, with the refugee kind of reality, I think there was a need to create a longer, bigger, more investigative project, and that became The Walk. Yeah. That was the original spark that started the idea of maybe we need to walk all the way from the border of Syria to Manchester in our first walk. And when we started that, we didn't think this will become a global phenomenon.
Yeah,
and she became a symbol.
Yeah, absolutely. And she is that symbol of the unaccompanied child. But also, given the height, because this puppet is a magnificent creation, her height, her facility in terms of movement, you are not only talking about a child unaccompanied, you're talking about a very powerful being.
We are very, very lucky to be working with Handspring Puppet Company, who are the creators of Warhorse and are one of the most acclaimed puppet companies in the world. Mm. They created a real thing of beauty for us. She is very, very big and fierce, but she's also very vulnerable. And I think that's part of what makes her so beautiful on the streets. She interacts like a 10-year-old. You can see her think. You can see her breathe. She's not a big mechanical structure. She is very, very human in the way she moves, because she's only operated by people, which was one of the first requirements. We asked them to not have any big machines.
Yeah.
Usually, after a certain height, you'll need some kind of mechanics. Here, we kind of stretched the limit of how high we can do it without, and just human operated. And because of that, she is very human. She interacts with everybody. It's immediate, and I think that's why she becomes very, very relatable for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean,
I think the biggest testimony of her power is that we've been to, I don't know, 90 cities so far. In every city, I hear somebody else say, "She is me." And sometimes it's a refugee from Syria, and that's very understandable. Sometimes it's a refugee from Africa, but sometimes it's an elderly woman who remembers what it feels to be lost and 10 years old. And throughout these journeys, we've heard this again and again and again. One of the most moving moments in New York was an old man who grabbed me from my hand and said, "I am a survivor of the Holocaust. I know what it's to be a child walking around. I walked through Europe. And now I'm an old man and I'm here, and she is me." And I think that's a testament of how moving she can be if you let her.
And I guess that man speaking to you about that must have brought thoughts of your own parents to mind. You might give us a little bit of your own family background, which is most interesting.
It's interesting, like every family. My mom and dad were very, very, very special people, and I grew up in a household which was very loving and very, very special. My mom happens to be a Jew. My father is a Palestinian Muslim, and they lived together with lots of love and lots of respect. And that shouldn't be that odd. There's a long, long history of cohabitants between the Muslims and the Jews. And our household was one of these households. I'm a Palestinian. I identify as a Palestinian. And in the East, there was a long, long, long tradition of Jews living very, very well amongst the Arabs. We didn't have centuries of persecution like in Europe. Mm. And that's going into the politics and into the pain of this moment. But it is important to say maybe it's important to say this now, because I think part of the problem back home, which is an awful problem, and is one of, you know, it's as low as it gets right now with everything that's happening. But it's important to remember that at the end of the day, the Jews were welcomed and were part of the space as long as they were part of the space. Now they are not. Now they are an occupying power, which is part of the problem.
And it must break your heart, given the way you've described your own family and that combination of Jewishness and Palestinian, you know, to see the way things are at this current moment. Your previous work and your involvement in theatre, if we just even start with that, how unusual was it, Amir, for a young boy growing up as you did, where you did, to have an interest in theatre? And how did that interest come about?
It started by me bumping into a rehearsal theater, a rehearsal of a small amateur company that was in East Jerusalem. And the minute I saw that, I fell in love. And there was something about the immediacy of the exercise, the immediacy of the fraudulent exercise of being somewhere else, of not being part of your... And the potency of the storytelling that became very, very beautiful for me. I was 15, about to become 16 when that happened. And ever since, theater has become my life. I think it's the most beautiful art form. It's the most human of art forms. It's modest. And it's all about a community coming together to share a story and to share a moment, which I can't think of anything more human to do. So... So it was very natural, you know, it became a way to express myself, to express my realities, to express my complexity in my reality. And growing up like I did, obviously, is a complicated, you know, it's a complicated thing. I think the Irish will understand more than others, that when you're raised on both sides of the divides, you're constantly renegotiating who you are in the conversation.
And I guess that was there, Amir, in one of your previous plays, I Am Yosef and This Is My Brother, which looked at what is referred to as the Nabka, which for one side of the community in your part of the world is an occasion for celebration. For another side of the community in your part of the world is an occasion for serious grief. This was at the point at which hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were uprooted from their homes, never to return. Tell me about how you explored that very difficult and that complex conflict situation in that play.
You know, the play talks about two brothers that are separated in the midst of war and what happens to them. It's a story about an ethnic cleansing, and the story of the Nakba in 1948 is a story of an ethnic cleansing that happened. Obviously, you know, one side of my family fled Europe, but that resulted in another side of my family having to pay the price of being ethnically cleansed and expelled because of a sin they weren't part of. Regardless of the politics of the region for the last 75 years, there's a very clear story of displacement, of uprooting whole villages, whole communities, in order to create basically a colonial settler, new country out of nothing. And I'm very Palestinian, and I'm very outspoken as a Palestinian, mainly because I'm very Jewish in my heritage, in my upbringing. And it's important to say that, because a lot of the times the politics becomes, if you're opposing Israel, you're an anti-Semite. If you think that Israel needs to change, you're an anti-Semite. And I'm not opposing Israel. I don't want the Israelis to disappear. It's also impossible that they will. They grow up there. They are part of the land now. But I want Israel to change. I want Israel to change dramatically. I want Israel to understand that it can't continue doing what it's doing to its neighbors, to the people who are sharing this land, and they won't go away either. And the power on the land is Israel, and it's the aggressor, and it's the occupier, and it needs to change 180 degrees. not disappear. No, I'm not talking about any violence, but it needs to change its ways completely. Like South Africa had to change, like apartheid had to change.
And it struck me too, as you're describing that situation, both in South Africa that you've just touched on, and previously around the Nakba and your play, I Am Yusuf and This Is My Brother, coming back to The Walk and Little Amal, you gave us some wonderful descriptions earlier on of how welcomed she was in various places that she went. However, it wasn't all roses on the street. I think in one particular situation in Greece, wasn't it, where there was quite diametrically opposed reactions to Little Amal.
Yeah, we weren't welcomed everywhere. There were places that didn't want us to come, and we never went to these places. There were places that a certain fraction in a community thought that we shouldn't be there. But, and I'm saying this, also when I'm talking about my own conflict, I believe that people are inherently good. I believe that most people want a good life. I believe that most people want to raise children that live in prosperity and comfort. I think people are inherently good. I think people want to be welcoming. I think people want to share their cultures. I think we're held captive by mongreling politicians who profit from fear. And fear is very easy to market to people. And I think we can market hope. I want to believe that hope is as powerful a potion against the venom of fear. And when I look at what's happening in my homeland with all the despair, with all the destruction, with this horrible genocide that is happening right now, I want to celebrate the resilience of the people. I want to celebrate the fact that even in these dire moments of despair, there's still creativity, there's still hope, there's still, even now, children running around the rubbles of Gaza, trying, clutching to life. I want to celebrate them. I don't want to celebrate death. I don't want to celebrate destruction. I don't want to celebrate these metallic eagles that can drop one-ton bombs on buildings. I want to celebrate the resilience, the creativity, the ingenuity, you know, the bravery of people that are walking across continents to provide better lives for themselves, for their children. That should be something that mankind, that we should celebrate and embrace.
Absolutely. Well, Amir,
not fear.
Fear is the enemy. There's no doubt about that. And let us celebrate all of those very positive words that you mentioned: ingenuity, creativity, and particularly hope, which I guess is embodied in Little Amal and The Walk that will be coming to us soon. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, Amir.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That is Amir Nizar Zurbi, Creative Director of Walk with Amal. Little Amal will be in Uri Town Hall 1 p.m. tomorrow, Market Square in Dundalk, 6:30 p.m. On Thursday, she comes to Wood Quay in the Amphitheatre in City Hall, 10 a.m. Later at 3:30, she will be at the International Literature Festival in Merrion Square. And finally then, Little Amal will be at the Famine Memorial at Custom House Quay at 7:30, alongside those static statues that are walking in many ways off to their new homes. That's, she'll be beside the Samuel Beckett Bridge at 9:15 p.m. Series of family-friendly activities in Dublin during Amal's visit, including performances from Branner, Ireland's leading theatre company for children, Junk Ensemble, Colm Ó Conamara, and many others. dublin.ie/Amal or walkwithamal.org for full details on all of that. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Barbara Sanwell, or is it Wednesday? I think it is Wednesday, isn't it? No, it's Tuesday. Niall Fitzmaurice and Barbara Sanwell were the researchers this evening. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will be back with you tomorrow night, Wednesday night, at 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.